Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we dissect the most anticipated launch of the year, the release of Apple's new tablet computer, the iPad. Released last week, the new gadget has got geeks' fingers a-tapping, but will it be a hit outside the techno circles?
Well, I went through several phases. I was incredibly excited by the beauty of it when I unwrapped it, and it's got that wow factor that all Mac products have. And then I went through a sort of lull after about 10 minutes. I'd sort of got a bit bored with it and I couldn't really work out what to do with it. And then I went home and loaded up lots more apps. And after about 5 hours, I really began to see the point of it and enjoy it. Now, whether I'm going to be completely convinced by it, I don't know. It feels like an interim piece of tech. I know all technology is in interim these days, but it really does feel like a stepping stone to something else. But I think it's probably quite a significant stepping stone.
Well, everyone's a critic. That was The Guardian's editor Alan Rusbridger with the new Apple iPad. So what implications does the burgeoning tablet and smartphone market have for the web browsing experience? Jack Schofield spoke with user interaction expert Jacob Nielsen about the future of web design. And we'll also be looking at what the communications regulator Ofcom proposes should happen to you if you illegally share copyrighted material over the internet, part of the first wave of implementations of the controversial Digital Economy Act. Joining me to discuss these stories and the rest of this week's news are technology editor Charles Arthur and new media correspondent Jemima Kish. Welcome to you both.
Hola.
Hello.
Hola, indeed. We are a multicultural, multilinguistic podcast. Are you going to speak in Spanish the whole time, Jemima?
Good. ¿Cómo estás?
Have you got an iPad, Jemima?
I'm actually going to get one in about an hour. Yes, obviously can't pass judgment.
So we can't delay too long?
No. Can we hurry up with it? I don't know. I don't want to make too much of a judgment until I've properly lived with it, really. I have had a brief play with one, but it's not enough. So I am very curious about how, or if indeed, it will kind of fit into my lifestyle and whether it replaces my phone or replaces my desktop computer at home.
To be continued.
To be continued.
Charles, did you manage to get an iPad?
No, I didn't want one. Well, haven't got the money for one. And, I've got computers. We've got computers coming out of our ears. We've got enough computers, and I don't have the slot into which it would fit, I don't think.
In terms of PowerPoints or in terms of
In terms of, there aren't points in my life when I'm sort of wanting to just sort of consume stuff in that way. If I do, I've got an iPod Touch, I use that, or else I use my computer, got a laptop.
Well, we've got two polar opposite views here, and we shall be exploring those later on in the podcast. So keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly for the best technology news and commentary from The Guardian. Here's this week's technology news. First, the Apple iPad was released to the overexcited masses last week. Charles Arthur went along on Thursday afternoon, the day before launch, to see if anyone was queuing outside the Regent Street Apple store in London. Tell us what you found there, Charles.
Well, it was quite a nice day, you know, fairly sunny, not raining, no hail. So I thought that possibly a bit like the iPhone, when I seem to recall that there were queues before, that there might, by sort of late afternoon, be a fair number of people queuing there. Instead, what I found was a fairly desultory queue of about five people, three of whom had all come down at the same time, and who were all friends of the person at the front, who was a guy called Jake Lee. And the question that occurred to me, which I think had occurred to everyone, was, well, why didn't you bother to order it online? Wouldn't that be simpler? Why not buy it online?
I could have. Originally, I was going to import one from the US, but it's so tricky and there's no insurance or anything like that. And then there's a couple of reasons why I didn't order it in the UK. You know, on payday, I remember the orders got set back to the 7th of June, and I wanted it, you know, I wanted it on release. So I thought atmosphere's going to be great on the day, so I just decided to come up here early.
What time are they opening tomorrow?
8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Hi, I'm Charles Arthur from The Guardian. So you're second in the queue. What's your name?
Joe Woodcock.
So you're a friend of Jake?
Yeah.
Okay. Why didn't you? I mean, you're trying one out now, but why didn't you order it online?
The main reason I didn't consider ordering it online is because the atmosphere here is so great. Like, we're getting lab free stuff, and it's just such a good. Also, I'm here with my two friends, so. it's quite a good atmosphere. Yeah.
How are you going to afford it? I mean, it's not cheap. What sort of job do you do?
Well, I'm actually a freelance web designer, and like, fair enough, I'm only 17. I'm not like the most experienced person in the world, but I get like odd ends here and there. So, also, I just have a really supportive family. So,
at the moment, I'm in full-time education, and I've also got a job. I serve food and stuff at a bar. Saving money up for about 4 months, so you know, it's all out of my own pocket.
Which one are you going to get?
I'm going to get the 64 gig model Wi-Fi.
Why would you buy an iPad rather than, I mean, for the same money you could buy a netbook?
In my opinion, I don't like netbooks. No, I think they're very slow. The operating systems aren't that amazing. This operating system's so simple to run. It's got this 10-hour battery life with it, so much better performance.
What about, you're going to be camping overnight. That's going to get pretty cold, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got my dad's big fluffy coat, so...
Like, no sleeping bag, no tent?
No, I'm going old school on this. No, I'll be all right. It won't be too bad, hopefully.
Okay, thanks very much.
No problem, cheers.
Well, the queue outside the Apple store isn't what you'd call the biggest. It's about 4 or 5 people at best, although it's only 3:40. Perhaps there's time for it to get a lot bigger before 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. But the signs are it's not going to be quite as big a hit as the iPhone. Perhaps it's more like the iPod, which was a slow grower. But then again, people who were walking past who are seeing them trying out some iPads that people have brought along were all cooing over it and making the sort of noises that tends to mean that Apple's come up with another, potential hit, but only time will tell.
That was Charles speaking with some of the people queued up on Thursday afternoon for their new iPads. But the story was different, wasn't it, Charles, on Friday morning?
It was. I was astonished to find when I was checking my Twitter feed that there were pictures. There were hundreds of people, 425, I think, when the store opened, and the queue grew to 1,000. My queue turned out to be completely wrong. Everyone just said, hey, you know, let's wait until it opens.
Ah, but do you think this is... This is a question I asked you on Twitter, actually. Do you think that they were bought in? Do you think that they were shipped in? Do you think they were real people? Or do you think that Stephen Fry was also appearing at the Apple store that particular morning because he was launching Fry Paper or whatever his iPad app is? Do you think they were coming along to see Stephen Fry as opposed to queuing up to get the Apple iPad?
I think that's faintly possible, but I think that based on the sort of reports about the number that were shipping and going out, that more likely there was a lot of. I mean, okay, Stephen Fry's interesting, but you know, with all respect, dear Stephen, is he that fascinating to see him launching an app that you'd actually turn up at 8 o'clock in the morning? I think that it's more to do with. Attraction of the gadget, because it had a lot of advertising. Yeah, you know, there were billboards and things all over the city, and newspaper adverts.
Who knows how the mysterious Apple PR machine works?
Indeed. Well, they certainly don't send anything out to reviewers ahead of time, which is very interesting. They work on their existing brand identity.
Can't trust us.
But it is interesting. They have announced that they've already sold over 2 million units in less than 60 days. So, Charles, why do you think it is a hit as opposed to some of the other netbooks? You asked some of the people there why they didn't buy other netbooks.
Apple's very good at the marketing side. I mean, 2 million, that is $1 billion in revenue. You know, at an average $500 each. That's going to make a huge difference to their bottom line this quarter. Why are they doing well when everyone else isn't? Well, it's where Apple excels is in the user interface and the hardware design. And it turns out, I think, that is really the thing that people are starting to think about when they're looking at a computing device. It used to be that you had a lot of choices of computing device and you thought, well, I don't know, it's all much the same. But over the course of many years, you know, going back from the iPod and working forward, people have started to look to Apple now, I think, for, you know, the user interface thing. And they've said, actually, yeah, the user interface is worth paying a little bit more for. And with the iPhone, the iPod Touch, you know, something like 70 million units of those out there, I think that people are starting to say, okay, well, I could have a netbook, but then again, I could have this. And if they've already got a laptop or a desktop, then I'm not sure they see a netbook as a necessary addition.
Now, Jemima, you say you're going to get one in the next few hours. I've had a go on an iPad. They're nice toys. I've found them very interesting. There's a couple of apps on there that I think are really beautiful, but nothing necessarily that's going to make me, you know, flop out a couple of hundred.
Have you not tried Talking Carl?
but I haven't yet seen
Angry
any
Birds.
Killer apps. What do you think would be a killer app that would attract not just the pre-buy, the pre-order geek community to flock to the Apple Store?
Well, I mean, it's all, it comes down to what's relevant to you, because there is no one single killer app. It depends who you are and what you do and what you enjoy doing. I think for gamers, I know the Scrabble app, you can also use it on your iPhone so that you can keep the letters as your little rack on your iPhone, and then the main game is on the iPad. You know, little details like that are just lovely. To go back to what Charles said as well, I do think the touchscreen is the single most significant development of the iPad. And already there's a whole slew of other touchpad notebook-sized machines. In terms of apps, I think that one interesting one I've seen so far, because I rely really heavily on an RSS aggregator, there's a new one called Pulse, which has been developed by a student team. Very, very smart looking. And I think if you can, well, for me anyway, a killer app would be an app that managed to combine your own personal kind of information world in one place in a very picture-friendly, video-friendly way.
But how is this any different from what you can access on your iPhone?
Well, it's not unless you need to be able to watch video and you want a lot of pictures and a kind of a good visual experience. Conveniently, my laptop died, so it's actually going to save me having to get a full laptop, which I don't really need now. So it was kind of good timing for me in a way. But I think this, the ability to manipulate images and kind of interact with them more physically is a really, really interesting development. And I think once developers really understand that and the possibilities for how you can interact with content and manipulate it on the screen, then things will start getting really interesting on a content side.
We'll be talking about the user interface in a little bit. But Charles, very briefly, what are the implications of the iPad's success on sites that utilize Flash? For example, The Guardian uses a lot of Flash. So what are the implications there for websites and designers and content providers?
Well, the implications are that they'll have to come up with alternatives. This is a large audience already, 2 million, and growing. And if it won't work, if your website won't work, then you're a bit stuffed. But just going very briefly back to what Jemima said, I think that the killer app is not sort of an app as such. It's immersion. It's being able to immerse yourself in what you're doing.
Absolutely.
And not be distracted by anything else. And I think that's actually going to be what the iPad does.
Well, also in this week's news, the battle for the top market share in the technology space shifted from the incumbent Microsoft to the iKiller Apple. Steve Jobs' company was valued at $222 billion, while Bill Gates' hardware and software giant was valued at $219 billion. Charles, can you break down the numbers for us?
Sure. This number is referring to the market capitalization. That is the number of shares outstanding multiplied by the share price. And you can actually see these for yourself if you go to wolframalpha.com, which is the search engine, and type in AAPL, that's the Apple stock ticker, and MSFT, which is the Microsoft one, and it will give you a comparison of all the relevant numbers for them. The latest ones are that Apple's market capitalization is $233.7 billion, Microsoft's $226.1 billion. What does market cap mean? Market cap is the market's estimate of the entire future profits of a company. So that is, it's basically saying how much is each share worth. So you can imagine that if you had a company which had no revenues at all but had $1 billion in cash and there were a million shares outstanding, then a fair price per share would be $1,000 for someone to buy it back privately. If you had a company which is going to be earning $1 billion this year and the equivalent of $1 billion next year, the equivalent of $1 billion a year after for 20 years, and then it's going to stop, okay, that's $20 billion, you would then say, okay, well, the share price, the market capitalization should be $20 billion. So what the market is saying is, we think Apple's future profits are going to total $233 billion, Microsoft's are going to be $226 billion. And it's basically crossed over. The market reckons that Microsoft's future prospects are less than Apple's. It sort of looks at where Apple is growing, looks at where Microsoft is growing, and says, well, one of them's growing faster than the other. So, when you come to the revenues, Microsoft is still bigger, 58 billion as against 42 billion. Employees, Apple is much smaller, 36,800 compared to 93,000 for Microsoft, which means that Apple's revenue per employee is much bigger. It's about a million per compared to 637. Net income, again, Microsoft is much bigger, 16 billion compared to Apple's 7.4. But the fact is that Apple is catching up really quite fast now. You know, it may be that by the end of the year or in 12 months' time, that Apple will actually have equivalent profits to Microsoft with fewer staff and possibly even a comparable revenue.
So, Charles, basically what this is looking at, this is a forecast more than anything else. So do you think that this is a market anomaly? Will Microsoft be able to claw back?
If Microsoft can find ways to really come back, if it can, for example, start winning share in search engines, if it can start to make money from online, because it's not doing that at all. Its online services division is just a big heap of red ink. If it can make some inroads into the mobile space with Windows Phone 7, which is due in the autumn, then yes, the market will look at it and say, okay, these guys have got prospects. But as it stands at the moment, it's just not doing it. You know, it's just not convincing the people who buy its shares. And that's with Microsoft having the advantage that it pays a dividend. So if you own Microsoft shares, you get 2%, in fact, of the money back every year. Apple doesn't pay a dividend, which doesn't make it an advantage to own the shares.
Well, Jemima, I think part of what Charles is saying is that Microsoft have done quite a good job at diversifying in terms of the online space and in terms of software. But really, it seems that Apple have done quite a phenomenal job in terms of getting people to buy their hardware. Would you say that this result is part of the iPhone phenomenon, the iTouch phenomenon, or is it due to a cultural shift that suddenly people want an alternative to Microsoft, or is it due to the clever way that Apple runs its business,
It's all of the above. And in no small part, it's down to Apple's amazing marketing machine. But what they have done with each of their products is clearly kind of fenced out a part of a content market. So obviously the music market was a big one, and now moving into publications and books and films as well. And there's going to be rumours of streamed and live music on the iTunes store as well. So they have an extremely strong content proposition on devices that are completely linked, from people's online storage through to their phones, to their desktop computer, and obviously their mobile computing. And although Microsoft does synchronise across those platforms, I think the offering is a lot less coherent. Perhaps it's also a question of not so much what Microsoft has done wrong, but just Apple's phenomenal success at, doing things right.
Very briefly, Charles, what do you think that this means overall for the tech business? Do you think people are going to start making more people are going to start making products for Apple than for Microsoft? I mean, perhaps we're seeing this already with all the Apple app developers, but in terms of the content, in terms of companies, are we going to start seeing a shift of people moving towards the Apple ranch?
Microsoft is really broad. It's very easy to lose sight of how broad a business it is. And there are loads of people who are still building stuff on top of Microsoft products. Don't forget all the sort of the SharePoints and all the other sorts of things that it does. But a lot of that isn't visible in Microsoft revenues because people are basically just using the platform tools and building on that. So there's a huge ecosystem which still relies on Microsoft. There are more app developers who are developing content for Apple, so things like the iPhone, things like the iPad are enormously popular. And there are people who are building off those things as well. So the ecosystem that sort of hangs off Apple, if you like, is still rather, very, very much smaller than for Microsoft. But there is a subtle shift going on here. I mean, and don't forget Android, which is going to be doing the same. The Android ecosystem is starting to grow fast as well.
Finally, Ofcom released the first draft of a document outlining the actions that should be taken by internet service providers against suspected file sharers. The report was required by the Digital Economy Act, which was pushed through Parliament in April this year. It describes a type of three-strike system already widely adopted in Europe, in which suspected copyright infringers will receive three written warnings before the copyright owner can begin legal action against them.
The code drew immediate comment from critics, including the UK's second largest ISP, TalkTalk, and consumer liberties groups like the Open Rights Group and Citizens Advice. Charles, briefly, what was outlined in the code?
Basically, it's how the how much information has to be collected by music and film companies, the copyright owners, when they're making a report to an ISP, how it is that ISPs have to react, how quickly they have to send out letters, and also how they can create a copyright infringement list. If you're placed on that, then the copyright owners can start taking action against you. Although if you're placed on the list, it's then deleted every year. It's a bit like the driving license and the point system.
Jemima, what's been the response?
Well, Jim Killock from the Open Rights Group quite rightly said that people would be uncomfortable with this level of surveillance, which I think is true. I mean, it's just another kind of layer on top of the CCTV nation that we've also become. But responses to this story on the Guardian site included R.C. Knows, who is making the point that technology is always going to be one step ahead. He just said, can anyone recommend a good proxy service? You know, it's kind of obvious point to make, but very true, that it doesn't matter what kind of legislation they put in place. It's almost impossible for them to stay ahead of the technology because people will always root around it. And the really clever, really persistent, heavy users and sharers of copyrighted material are always going to be able to find a way of downloading this data and sharing it without being able to be traced. And there's a number of ways to do that.
Well, also, Charles, this is only relevant to ISPs that have more than 400,000 customers. Do you think that this is a big enough story, that people in general are aware of this enough, that this could potentially rebalance how the hierarchy of the different ISPs?
Well, you might see some people moving away from some of the bigger ISPs, perhaps BT, to small ones. Although TalkTalk, which is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, has come out saying that it thinks that there's a lack of consideration of data protection issues, that there's not enough about how customers can access fair and just appeals. And they're worried also that it could kill off public Wi-Fi networks. So I suspect that there might be some people who'll move away to smaller ISPs, although the whole trend in the ISP market is of consolidation. You know, the little ones get bought out by the large ones just because there's economies of scale there. So I think that that's going to be a very small scale thing. And also Ofcom could look at how well the code's working, and it can start to look at smaller ISPs as well. It can also look at mobile phone networks if it thinks that piracy is moving onto those.
The draft code is in consultation until the 30th of July. You can read up on the rest of this week's news stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. The world of web design used to work within very specific boundaries, back when it was only about browsing on a desktop or a laptop. But now, with the mainstreaming of smartphones and tablet technology, the world of web design has been turned on its head. Navigating the web on a touchscreen is clearly different to navigating the web with a keyboard and mouse. So, how have user interaction experts adapted to the new opportunities presented by the new platforms? Jakob Nielsen is a principal of the Nielsen Norman Group, the usability experts, who recently held one of their annual conferences in London. Jack Schofield went to meet him, and he asked him about a recent usability study on the iPad. So, how did Apple's new baby perform?
In some ways, less well than I had expected. There were really a lot of usability problems in this first generation of iPad applications. Of course, I should say this was the first generation because it was an early study, and maybe findings would be different in a year, but all we can do is test what we have. And right now, these applications are often quite difficult for people to discover what they can do, because the user interface, the options are not very visible, they're very hidden. The iPad very much emphasizes very pretty and beautiful pictures. I have to say the attractiveness of both the device itself, but also of the content and the applications, it's very, very attractive, which is good, but at the same time, overemphasizing the attractiveness and just sort of hiding the functionality, that does cause problems. And then the second compounding issue is that everybody is different. So every time you go and if you pick up a few different magazines, for example, every one of them will treat the articles and the pictures differently. Like, how do you go to the next article? Well, different in each application. What can you do with the picture? Can you enlarge it? Can you not enlarge it? Are there extra pictures? How do you get the extra pictures? All that is different. The problem with it being different is then you can't learn.
But surely people are used to dealing with different applications on the web.
They are, but they also don't like that. And also I think that the web has by now evolved a fairly large set of conventions. So for example, on e-commerce sites, it's common that there's a product photograph and you can enlarge it, usually just by clicking on it. That's usually the way you do it. So it's relatively well known how to deal with these basic things. Similarly, if an article is too long, well, there are really two ways of dealing with it being too long. And the first one is scrolling, which people really know how to do. And the second one is there's a little kind of arrow that says next page, and then you know how to click on that as well. And then there's another one called previous page. And I mean, you can certainly do it differently, and any website that does it differently will have problems. But most websites do it in this kind of conventional way, and people know how to do that, deal with that.
Do you have any view on the Flash versus HTML5 issue? Because Flash isn't generally known for its usability.
Now, Flash is, I think quite often misused to cause kind of grievances in the user interface by being flashy. I mean, the very name kind of implies that. That said, I think that Flash has also, in later years, been used also more for useful things, such as, for example, video. And in my view, there's no real need to change to another technology once we have one that works pretty well. But, you know, Apple doesn't seem to like Adobe, I guess, and so they're kind of pushing that we should change to HTML5. But from the user perspective, which is, again, what I'm trying to advocate, there I don't think it makes much of a difference, because what really makes a difference is how you use that technology. Do you use flashy, blinking, annoying elements on the screen, or do you show a video in a nice, controlled manner and the user can say start or stop as they please? Then do it one way or the other way. Technically, doesn't really matter.
Yeah, this is beginning to sound... Well, it's a discussion we've been having for decades about the conflict between usability and eye candy. Is one of them winning, finally?
Well, I think actually on the web, usability is winning, but on the iPad, the eye candy is winning. But I think for the iPad, it's still so early days that it's not. We can't really say what will win. But I think on the web, I mean, there's definitely still sites you go to that are nothing but glamour, and you can't get any real information out of them. But most of the sites that are really successful sites do tend to actually by now emphasize usability a fair amount, which does not mean that they're perfect. So actually here at this conference this week, we have a presentation that's called Big and Famous Sites. And for that presentation, we did a study of 20, well, big and famous websites. And so the two conclusions out of that are, first of all, that they actually do a lot of things in really nice ways, and that's kind of how they became big and famous. At the same time, even the big and famous sites don't do everything right. I mean, we have on Amazon.com, or the most famous e-commerce sites, sometimes people cannot find the products. I mean, we still don't have perfect website for sure.
If you look at big and famous, that's Amazon, eBay, Yahoo. They tend to be not big and pretty sites.
That's exactly true, and I think that's really almost the point, that what users really want is they want that instant gratification. The faster they can get their answers, the better. People don't really go to websites to just kind of admire them. And again, that could be a little bit different with the iPad, because the iPad is so just attractive that you do kind of say, wow, this does look good. And I'm sometimes questioned whether this will last or it's just a temporary infatuation phase. But for sure on websites, we know from many years now that people get very bored actually with pretty sites. They get excited about useful site, a site that will do something for them. And that becomes the engagement, and that becomes therefore the pleasure and the repeat engagement, which is actually the really important point if you think of it from a business perspective. So you want them to not just have once, oh, this is nice. You want them to have, this is great. This is actually something for me. People are very selfish on the web too. Is there something for me on this site? Then they'll come back again and again and again.
Jakob Nielsen from Nielsen Norman Group. Jemima, which websites do you feel have the best user interaction on the web right now?
Well, I kind of turn that on its head by saying that anything that you think is good now is going to be completely undone in the next few years as touchscreens become the default way of people interacting with content on screen. And, you know, I don't know, 2-3 years, place bets on how long that's going to be. But we will look back at footage of us at the moment, you know, using this very unergonomic kind of lumpy thing on the desk with a pointer on the screen and just think it was absolutely ridiculous. The implications for the content on screen and how you interact with that are so vast and really exciting as well. And again, particularly for visual content like photos and videos and things. So how will your hands sit on the desk, or how will they sit on the screen? What will be the default bar where, say, the heel of your hand is? And I think the layout of the screen as it is at the moment, the hot patch kind of being top left, it may all just be completely undone, and we may have a landscape and a kind of a territory to design where we have to start from scratch.
It's also exciting just to think about how much the user interaction, how much the interface leads you through the website itself, leads you through the content itself. But Charles, taking a look, Jemima says that touchscreen is going to be a paradigm shift. Taking a look back over time, what would you say have been other paradigm shifts when it comes to web interaction?
Well, obviously, in terms of computer interaction, really, the real shift was from the command line to Windows. And then from when you added a mouse onto Windows, you get the capability for drag and drop. And it's easy to forget, actually, how revolutionary the whole idea of drag and drop was to people who are familiar with command lines, where you'd have to copy a file by typing a long thing. And if you got one thing wrong, then who knows where the hell the file had gone. The whole things with mice then brought along the double click, the right click. Menus, of course, with Windows, which means you can have menus and submenus, and you can have cascading menus where you get all sorts of things done from a single point. You go to one point and you can do very powerful things to a selected piece of content. A thing that's happening now, I think, in terms of interaction with touchscreens is the double tap, where, for example, on the iPhone and I think on Android as well, when you double tap a column of text, it will expand to fill the screen so that you don't have to pinch and zoom it. So there's a lot going on in terms of user interaction. I mean, Jakob Nielsen was talking about Flash there, and he was sort of saying, hey, it's great for video. I don't see what Apple's got against it. But actually, the thing is that when you're looking at Flash, it's very much a web-based system. You've got to have a mouse there to be going over things and clicking on things. If you're trying to do it with touch, it's not as effective, and it really gets in the way. Where HTML5 and CSS3 are going to be able to give you that sort of interaction straight away.
For more on user interaction, a fascinating blend of design and psychology, go to Jakob's website, useit.com. Or for a more academic take, search for human-computer interaction studies in your local library or on Google. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Our producer today was Kate Taylor. I'm Alex Kratowski. Tune in next week to check out the big iPhone news. We'll have everything that you need to know about that story and much more. Keep your eyes peeled on guardian.co.uk/technology and let us know what you expect on our Twitter feed @GuardianTW. Thanks for listening.